fall, or raced down a mountain with Drizzt and Catti Bree. Guinevere had known grief before, when some of her previous masters had died. This time, though, there could be no replacement for Drizzt, and none for Catti Bree or Regis, or even Brunner, that most frustrating of creatures whose love and hate relationship with Guinevere had provided the panther with many hours of teasing enjoyment. Guinevere remembered the time Drizzt had bade her lie atop sleeping Brunner and nap. How the dwarf had roared! Flames bit at Guinevere's face. She could see through the breach now, see the emptiness that awaited her. Somewhere far off, beyond the shield of the screeching wind, came Drizzt's call, a call the cat could not answer. Chapter 7 Beanri's Fault. Euthygental Armgo, the patron and weapons master of Barrison del Armgo, second house of Menzo Berenzon, was not Jarlaxle's favorite drow. In fact, Jarlaxle wasn't certain that this one was truly a drow at all. Standing near 6 feet, with a muscled torso that weighed close to 200 pounds, Euthygental was the largest dark elf in Menzo Berenzon, one of the largest of the normally slender race ever seen in the Underdark. More than size distinguished the fierce weapons master, though. While Jarlaxle was considered eccentric, Euthygental was simply frightening. He cropped his white hair short and spiked it with the thick gelatinous extract gained by boiling Rothay udders. A mithril ring was stuck through Euthygentol's angular nose, and a golden pin protruded through each cheek. His weapon was a trident, black like the fine-fitting mail of jointed plates he wore, and a net, magical, so it was said, hung on his belt within easy reach. Jarlaxle was glad that at least Euthygentol wasn't wearing his war paint this day, zigzagging streaks of some dye the mercenary did not know, that showed yellow and red in both the normal and infrared spectrums. It was common knowledge in Menzo Berenzon that Euthygentol, in addition to being patron to Matron Mother Mesbaris, was the consort of many Barris and Del Armgo females. The second house considered him breeding stock, and the thought of dozens of little Euthygentals running around brought a sour expression to Jarlaxle's face.
"The magic is wild, yet I remain strong," the exotic weapons master growled, his perpetually furrowed brow making him even more imposing.
He held one iron-muscled arm to the side and tightened his biceps as he crooked his elbow, the rock-hard muscles of his arm standing high and proud. Jarlaxle took a moment to remind himself where he was, in the midst of his own encampment, in his own room and seated behind his own desk, secretly surrounded by a dozen highly skilled and undeniably loyal soldiers of Bracken d'Earth. Even without the concealed allies, Jarlaxle's desk was equipped with more than a few deadly traps for troublesome guests. And of course, Jarlaxle was no minor warrior himself. A small part of him, a very small part of him, wondered how he might measure up in battle against Euthygentol. Few warriors, drow or otherwise, could intimidate the mercenary leader, but he allowed himself a bit of humility in the face of this maniac.
"Ultran Sargatlan,"
Euthygentol went on, the drow term for supreme warrior, a claim that seemed secure within the city with Dantrag Beanri dead. Jarlaxle often imagined the battle that most of Menzo Berenzon's dark elves thought would one day be waged by bitter rivals Euthygentol and Dantrag. Dantrag had been the quicker than anyone, but with his sheer strength and size, Euthygentol had rated as Jarlaxle's favorite in such a contest. It was said that when he went into his battle rage, Euthygentol possessed the strength of a giant, and this fearsome weapons master was so tough that when he battled lesser creatures, such as goblin slaves, he always allowed his opponent to swing first, and never tried to parry the attack, accepting the vicious hit, reveling in the pain, before tearing his enemy limb from limb, and having the choicest body parts prepared for his supper. Jarlaxle shuddered at the notion, then put the image from his mind, reminding himself that he and Yutha Gentol had more important business.
"There is no weapons master, no drow at all in Menzo Baranzon to stand against me,"
Yutha Gentol continued his boasting, for no reason that Jarlaxle could discern beyond the savage's overblown sense of pride. He went on and on, as was his way, and while Jarlaxle wanted to ask him if there was a point to it all, he kept silent, confident that the emissary from the Second House would eventually get around to a serious discussion. Yutha Gentol stopped his mounting tirade suddenly, and his hand shot out, snatching from the top of the desk a gem that the mercenary used as a paperweight. Yutha Gentol muttered some word that Jarlaxle did not catch, but the mercenary's keen eye did note a slight flicker in the huge drow's brooch, the house emblem of Barrison del Armgo. Yutha Gentol then held the gem aloft and squeezed it with all his strength. The muscles in his sculpted arm strained and bulged, but the gem held firm.
"I should be able to crush this," Yutha Gentol growled. "Such is the power, the magic, that I have been loth blessed with."
"The gem would not be worth as much when reduced to powder," Jarlaxle replied dryly. What was Yutha Gentol's point, he wondered. Of course, something strange was going on with magic all over the city. Now Jarlaxle better understood Yutha Gentol's earlier boasting. The exotic weapons master was indeed still strong, but not as strong, a fact that apparently worried Yutha Gentol more than a little.
"Magic is failing," the weapons master said. "Failing everywhere. The priestesses kneel in prayer, sacrifice drow after drow, and still nothing they do brings Loth or her handmaidens to them. Magic is failing, and it is Matron Bayenri's fault."
Jarlaxle took note of the way Yutha Gentol seemed to repeat things. Probably to remind himself of what he was talking about, the mercenary mused, and his sour expression aptly reflected his opinion of Yutha Gentol's intellect. Of course, Yutha Gentol would never catch the subtle indication. "You cannot know that," the mercenary replied. Yutha Gentol's accusation no doubt came from Matron Mesbaris herself. Many things were coming clear to the mercenary now, mostly the fact that Mesbaris had sent Yutha Gentol to feel out Bregan de Earth, to see if the time was ripe for a coup against Bayenri. Yutha Gentol's words could certainly be considered damning, but not against Barris and Alarmgo, for their weapons master was always running off at the mouth, and never with anything complimentary to anyone but himself.
"It was Matron Bayenri who allowed the rogue Doerden to escape," Yutha Gentol bellowed. "It was she who presided over the failed high ritual. Failed, as magic is failing."
"Say it again," Jarlaxle thought, but wisely kept that derisive reply silent. The mercenary's frustration at that moment wasn't simply with the ignorance revealed by Yutha Gentol. It was with the fact that Yutha Gentol's reasoning was common all over the city. To Jarlaxle's thinking, the dark elves of Menzo Baranzon continually limited themselves by their blind insistence that everything was symptomatic of a deeper meaning, that the Spider Queen had some grand design behind their every movement. In the eyes of the priestesses, if Drizzt Do'Urden denied Loth and ran away, it was only because Loth wanted House Do'Urden to fall and wanted the challenge of recapturing him presented to the other ambitious houses of the city. It was a limiting philosophy, one that denied free will. Certainly Loth might play a hand in the hunt for Drizzt. Certainly she might be angered by the disruption of the high ritual, if she even bothered to take note of the event. But the reasoning that what was happening now was completely tied to that one event, ultimately a minor one in the 5,000-year history of Menzo Baranzon, was a view of foolish pride, wherein the dwellers of Menzo Baranzon seemed to think that all the multiverse revolved around them. "Why, then, is all magic failing every house?" Jarlaxle asked Yutha Gentol. "Why not just House Bayenri?" Yutha Gentol briskly shook his head, not even willing to consider the reasoning.
"We have failed Loth and are being punished," he declared. If only I had met the rogue instead of pitiful Dantrag Beenri.
Now that was a sight Jarlaxle would wish to see. Drizdo Erden battling Yutha Gentol. The mere thought of it sent a tingle down the mercenary's spine. You cannot deny that Dantrag was in Lolf's favor, Jarlaxle reasoned, while Drizdo Erden most certainly was not. How, then, did Drizzt win? Yutha Gentol's brow furrowed so fiercely that his red glowing eyes nearly disappeared entirely, and Jarlaxle quickly reassessed the prudence of pushing the brute along that line of reasoning. It was one thing to back Matron Beenri. It was another to shake the foundation for one religion-blinded slave's entire world. It will sort itself out properly, Jarlaxle assured. In all of Eric Tynaleth, in all of the Academy, and in every chapel of every house, prayers are being offered to Lolf.
Their prayers are not being answered, Yutha Gentol promptly reminded. Lolf is angry with us, and will not speak with us until we have punished those who have wronged her.
Their prayers were not being answered, or their prayers were not even being heard, Jarlaxle thought. Unlike most of the other typically xenophobic drow in Menzo Berenzon, the mercenary was in touch with the outside world. He knew from his contacts that Blingdenstone's Verfneblin priests were having equal difficulty in their communion, that the Deep Gnome's magic had also gone awry. Something had happened to the Pantheon itself, Jarlaxle believed, and to the very fabric of magic. It is not Lolf, he said boldly. To which Yutha Gentol's eyes went wide. Understanding exactly what was at stake here, the entire hierarchy of the city, and perhaps the lives of half of Menzo Berenzon's drow, Jarlaxle pressed ahead. Rather, it is not solely Lolf. When you go back into the city, consider Narbendel, he said, referring to the stone pillar clock of Menzo Berenzon. Even now, in what should be the cool dark of night, it glows brighter and hotter than ever before. So hot that its glow can even be viewed without the heat-sensing vision. So hot that any drow near the pillar cannot even allow their vision to slip into the heat-sensing spectrum, lest they be blinded. Yet Narbendel is enchanted by a wizard and not a priestess. Jarlaxle went on, hoping that dim Yutha Gentol would follow the reasoning.
"You doubt that Lolf could affect the clock?" the weapons master growled.
"I doubt she would," Jarlaxle countered vehemently. "The magic of Narbendel is separate from Lolf, has always been separate from Lolf. Before Gronth Beenri, some of the previous archmages of Menzo Berenzon were not even followers of Lolf." He almost added that Gromph wasn't so devout either, but decided to keep that bit of information back. No sense in giving the desperate second house additional reasons to think that House Beenri was even more out of the Spider Queen's favor. "And consider the fairy fires highlighting every structure," Jarlaxle continued. He could tell by the angle of Yutha Gentol's furrowed brow that the brute was suddenly more curious than outraged, not a common sight. "Blinking on and off, or winking out altogether. Wizard's fairy fire, not the magic of a priestess, and decorating every house, not just House Beenri. Events are beyond us, I say, and beyond the high ritual. Tell Matron Mesbaris, with all my respect, that I do not believe Matron Beenri can be blamed for this, and I do not believe the solution will be found in a war against the First House." Not unless Lolf herself sends us a clear directive. Yutha Gentol's expression soon returned to its normal scowl. Of course this one was frustrated, Jarlaxle realized. The most intelligent drow of Menzo Berenzon. The most intelligent Zwerfnebli of Blingdenstone were frustrated. And nothing Jarlaxle might say would change Yutha Gentol's mind or the war-loving savage's desire to attack House Beenri. But Jarlaxle knew he didn't have to convince Yutha Gentol. He just had to make Yutha Gentol say the right things upon his return to House Barrison Del Armgo. The mere fact that Mesbara sent so prominent an emissary, her own patron and weapons master, told Jarlaxle she would not lead a conspiracy against Beanre without the aid of, or at least the approval of, Bregan de Earth.
"I go," Yutha Gentol declared,
the most welcome words Jarlaxle had heard since the brute had entered his encampment. Jarlaxle removed his wide-brimmed hat and ran his hands over his bald pate as he slipped back comfortably into his chair. He could not begin to guess the extent of the events. Perhaps within the apparent chaos of the fabric of reality, Loth herself had been destroyed. Not such a bad thing, Jarlaxle supposed. Still, he hoped things would sort themselves out soon and properly, as he had indicated to Yutha Gentol, for he knew this request, and it was a request, to go to war would come again, and again after that, and each time it would be backed by increasing desperation. Sooner or later, House Beanre would be attacked. Jarlaxle thought of the encounter he had witnessed between Matron Beanre and Kioral Odron, matron mother of House Oblodra, the city's third, and perhaps most dangerous house, when Beanre had first begun to put together the alliance to send a conquering army to Mithril Hall. Beanre had dealt from a position of power then, fully in Loth's favor. She had openly insulted Kioral and the Third House, and forced the unpredictable matron mother into her alliance with bare threats. Kioral would never forget that, Jarlaxle knew, and she could possibly be pushing Mesbaris Delarmgo in the direction of a war against House Beanre. Jarlaxle loved chaos, thrived amidst confusion, but this scenario was beginning to worry him more than a little. Contrary to the usually correct mercenary's belief, Kioral Odron was not nudging Matron Mesbaris into a war against House Beanre. Quite the opposite. Kioral was working hard to prevent such a conflict, meeting secretly with the matron mothers of the six other ruling houses ranked below House Beanre, except for Jenny Tirith Tlabar, matron of House Faen Tlabar, the fourth house, whom Kioral could not stand and would not trust. It wasn't that Kioral had forgiven Matron Beanre for the insult, and it wasn't that Kioral was afraid of the strange events, far from it. If it hadn't been for their extensive scouting network beyond House Oblodra, and the obvious signs such as Narbondel and the Winking Fairy Fire, the members of the Third House wouldn't even have known that anything was amiss. For the powers of House Oblodra came not from wizardly magic, nor from the clerical prayers to the Spider Queen. The Oblodrans were psionicists. Their powers were formed by internal forces of the mind, and thus far, the time of troubles had not affected them. Kioral couldn't let the rest of the city know that. She had the score of priestesses under her command hard at work, forcing the psionic equivalent of fairy fire highlighting her house to blink, as were the other houses. And to Mesbaris and the other matron mothers, she seemed as agitated and nervous as they. She had to keep a lid on things. She had to keep the conspiracy talk quieted. For when Kioral could be certain that the loss of magic was not a devious trick, her family would strike alone. She might pay House Faen Tlabar back first, for all the years she had spent watching their every ambitious move, or she might strike directly against wretched Beanre. Either way, the wicked matron mother meant to strike alone. Matron Beanre sat stiffly in a chair on the raised and torchlit central dais in the great chapel of her house. Her daughter, Sosumtu, who served as caretaker to this most holy of drow places, sat to her left, and Triel, the eldest Beanre daughter, and matron mistress of the Drow Academy, was on her right. All three stared upward, to the illusionary image Gromph had put there, and it seemed strangely fitting that the image did not continue its shape-shifting from drow to arachnid and back again, but rather had been caught somewhere in the middle of the transformation and suspended there, like the powers that had elevated House Beanre to its preeminent position. Not far away, goblin and minotaur slaves continued their work in repairing the dome. But Matron Bayenry had lost all hope that putting her chapel back together would right the strange and terrible events in Menzo Berenzon. She had come to believe Jarlaxle's reasoning, that something larger than a failed high ritual and the escape of a single rogue was involved here. She had come to believe that what was happening in Menzo Berenzon might be symptomatic of the whole world, of the whole multiverse, and that it was quite beyond her understanding or her control. That didn't make things easier for Matron Bayenry. If the other houses didn't share those beliefs, they would try to use her as a sacrifice to put things right. She glanced briefly at both her daughters. Sosumtu was among the least ambitious drow females she had ever known, and Bayenry didn't fear much from that one. Triel, on the other hand, might be more dangerous. Though she always seemed content with her life as matron mistress of the academy, a position of no minor importance, it was widely accepted that Triel, the eldest daughter, would one day rule the first house. Triel was a patient one, like her mother. But like her mother, she was also calculating. If she became convinced that it was necessary to remove her mother from the throne of House Bayenry, that such an act would restore the Bayenry name and reputation, then she would do so mercilessly. That is why Matron Bayenry had recalled her from the academy to a meeting, and had located that meeting within the chapel. This was Sosumtu's place, Loth's place, and Triel would not dare strike out at her mother here. "I plan to issue a call from the academy that no house shall use this troubled time to war against another," Triel offered, breaking the virtual silence. For none of the Bayenrys had taken note of the hammering and groaning from the slaves working on the curving roof a mere 100 feet away. None of them took note even when a minotaur casually tossed a goblin to its death, for no better reason than enjoyment. Matron Bayenry took a deep breath and considered the words, and the meaning behind the words. Of course Triel would issue such a plea. The academy was perhaps the most stabilizing force in Menzo Berenzon. But why had Triel chosen this moment to tell her mother? Why not just wait until the plea was presented openly and to all? Was Triel trying to reassure her? Matron Bayenry wondered. Or was she merely trying to put her off her guard? The thoughts circled in Matron Bayenry's mind, ran around and collided with one another, leaving her in a trembling, paranoid fit. Rationally, she understood the self-destructive nature of trying to read things into every word, of trying to outguess those who might be less than enemies, who might even be allies. But Matron Bayenry was growing desperate. A few 10 days before, she had been at the pinnacle of her power, had brought the city together beneath her in readiness for a massive strike at the dwarven complex of Mithril Hall, near the surface. How fast it had been taken away! As fast as the fall of a stalactite from the ceiling of the cavern above her treasured chapel. She wasn't done yet, though. Matron Bayenry had not lived through more than 2,000 years to give up now. Damn Triel, if she was indeed plotting to take the throne. Damn them all! The matron mother clapped her hands together sharply, and both her daughters started with surprise as a bipedal, man-sized monstrosity popped into view, standing right before them, draped in tremendous flowing crimson robes. The creature's purplish head resembled that of an octopus, except that only 4 skinny tentacles waved from the perimeter of its round, many-toothed orifice, and its eyes were pupilless and milky white. The illithid, or mind flayer, was not unknown to the Bayenry daughters. Far from it. Elvidenvelp, or Methil as he was commonly called, was Matron Bayenry's advisor, and had been at her side for many years. Recovered from their startlement, both Sosumtu and Triel turned curious stares to their surprising mother.
"My greetings to you, Triel,"
the illithid imparted telepathically.
"And, of course, to you, Sosumtu, in this your place."
Both daughters nodded and conjured similar mental replies, knowing that Methil would catch the thoughts as clearly as if they had spoken them aloud.
"Fools!"
Matron Banri shouted at both of them. She leaped from her chair and spun around, her withered features fierce.
How are we to survive this time, if two of my principal commanders and closest advisers are such fools?
So Sumptu was beside herself with shame, wrought of confusion. She even went so far as to cover her face with the wide sleeve of her thick purple and black robe. Triel, more worldly wise than her younger sister, initially felt the same shock, but quickly came to understand her mother's point.
"The Elithid has not lost its powers," she stated.
And so Sumptu peeked curiously from above her arm.
"Not at all,"
Matron Banri agreed, and her tone was not happy.
"But then we have an advantage,"
so Sumptu dared to speak.
"For Methil is loyal enough,"
she said bluntly. There was no use in masking her true feelings behind words of half-truth, for the Elithid would read her mind anyway.
"And he is the only one of his kind in Menzo Baranzon."
"But not the only one who uses such powers,"
Matron Banri roared at her, causing her to shrink back in her chair once more.
"Kioral,"
Triel gasped.
"If Methil has use of his powers, then so do the Oblodrons,"
Banri finished grimly.
"They exercise their powers continually," Methil telepathically confirmed to all three. "The highlights of House Oblodra would not be winking were it not for the mental commands of Kioral's coven."
"Can we be certain of this?" Triel asked.
For there seemed no definite patterns in the failing of magic, just a chaotic mess. Perhaps Methil had not yet been affected, or did not even know that he had been affected. And perhaps Oblodra's fairy fire highlights, though different in creation than the fires glowing around the other houses, were caught in the same chaos.
"Psionic powers can be sensed by psionic creatures," Methil assured her. "The third house teems with energy."
"And Kioral gives the appearance that this is not so,"
Matron Banri added in a nasty tone.
"She wishes to attack by surprise," Triel reasoned.
Matron Banri nodded grimly.
"What of Methil?"
so Sumptu offered hopefully.
"His powers are great." "Methil is more than a match for Kioral,"
Matron Banri assured her daughter, though Methil was silently doing the same thing, imparting a sense of undeniable confidence.
"But Kioral is not alone among the Oblodrons with her psionic powers."
"How many?" Triel wanted to know, to which Matron Banri merely shrugged.
"Many,"
Methil's thoughts answered. Triel was thinking it, so she knew that Methil was hearing it, and so she said it aloud, suspiciously.
"And if the Oblodrons do come against us, which side will Methil take?"
Matron Banri was, for an instant, shocked by her daughter's boldness, but she understood that Triel had little choice in divulging her suspicions.
"And will he bring in his allies from the Elithid cavern not far away?"
Triel pressed.
"Surely if 100 Elithids came to our side in this our time of need—"
There was nothing from Methil, not a hint of telepathic communication, and that was answer enough for the Banris.
"Our problems are not the problems of the Mind Flayers,"
Matron Banri said. It was true enough, and she knew so. She had tried to enlist the Elithids in the raid on Mithril Hall, promising them riches and a secure alliance. But the motivations of the otherworldly, octopus-headed creatures were not the same as those of the Dark Elves, or of any race in all the Underdark. Those motivations remained beyond Matron Banri's understanding, despite her years of dealing with Methil. The most she could get from the Elithids for her important raid was Methil and two others agreeing to go along in exchange for 100 kobolds and a score of drow males, to be used as slaves by the Elithid community in their small cavern city. There was little else to say. The house guards were positioned at full readiness. Every spare drow was in prayer for help from the Spider Queen. House Bayenry was doing everything it could to avert disaster, and yet Matron Bayenry did not believe they would succeed. Kioril had come to her unannounced on several occasions, had gotten past her magical fence and past the many magical wards set around the complex. The matron mother of House Oblodra had done so only to taunt Bayenry, and in truth had little power remaining to do anything more than that by the time her image was revealed to Bayenry. But what might Kioril accomplish with those magical guards down, Bayenry had to wonder. How could Matron Bayenry resist the psionicist without countering magic of her own? Her only defense seemed to be Methil, a creature she neither trusted nor understood. She did not like the odds. Chapter 8 Magical Manifestations. Guinevere knew pain, knew agony beyond anything the panther had ever felt. But more than that, the panther knew despair, true despair. Guinevere was a creature formed of magic, the manifestation of the life force of the animal known on Toril as the panther. The very spark of existence within the great panther depended on magic, as did the conduit that allowed Drizzt and the others before him to bring Guinevere to the prime material plane. Magic having unraveled, the fabric that wove the universal weave into a mystical and predictable pattern, was torn. The panther knew despair. Guinevere heard Drizzt's continued calling, begging. The drow knew the cat was in trouble, and his voice reflected that desperation. In his heart, so connected with his panther companion, Drizzt O'Erden understood that Guinevere would soon be lost to him forever. The chilling thought gave the panther a moment of renewed hope and determination. Guinevere focused on Drizzt, conjured an image of the pain she would feel if she could never again return to her beloved master. Growling low in sheer defiance, the panther scraped her back leg so forcefully that more than one claw hooked on the smooth, hard surface and was subsequently yanked out. The pain did not stop the panther, not when Guinevere measured it against the reality of slipping forward into those flames, of falling out of the tunnel, the only connection to the material world and Drizzt O'Erden. The struggle went on for more time than any creature should have resisted. But though Guinevere had not slid any closer to the breach, neither had the panther earned back any ground toward her pleading master. Finally, exhausted, Guinevere gave a forlorn, helpless look over her shoulder. Her muscles trembled, then gave way. The panther was swept to the fiery breach. Matron Bayenry paced the small room nervously, expecting a guard to run in at any moment with news that the compound had been overrun, that the entire city had risen against her house, blaming her for the troubles that had befallen them. Not so long ago, Bayenry had dreamt of conquest, had aspired to the pinnacle of power. Mithril Hall had been within her grasp, and even more than that, the city seemed ready to fall into step behind her lead. Now she believed she could not hold on to even her own house, to the Bayenry Empire that had stood for 5,000 years. Mithril Hall! The wicked drow growled in a damning curse, as though that distant place had been the cause of it all. Her slight chest heaving with forced gasps of air, Bayenry reached with both hands to her neck and tore free the chain that lay there. "Mithril Hall!" she shouted into the ring-shaped pendant, fashioned from the tooth of Gandalag Battlehammer, the patron of Brunner's clan, the real link to that surface world. Every drow, even those closest to Matron Bayenry, thought Drizzt O'Erden was the catalyst for the invasion, the excuse that allowed Loth to give her blessing to the dangerous attempt at a conquest so near the surface. Drizzt was but a part of the puzzle, and a small part. for this little ring was the true impetus. Sealed within it was the tormented spirit of Gandalug, who knew the ways of Mithril Hall and the ways of Clan Battlehammer. Matron Beanri had taken the Dwarf King herself centuries before, and it was only blind fate that had brought a renegade from Menzo Berenson in contact with Brunner's clan. Blind fate that had provided an excuse for the conquest Matron Beanri had desired for many, many decades. With a shout of outrage, Beanri hurled the tooth across the room, then fell back in shock as the item exploded. Beanri stared blankly into the room's corner as the smoke cleared away, at the naked dwarf kneeling there. The matron mother pulled herself to her feet, shaking her head in disbelief, for this was no summoned spirit, but Gandalug's physical body.
"You dare to come forth?" Beanri screamed, but her anger masked her fear.
When she had previously called Gandalug's physical form forth from the extra-dimensional prison, he was never truly whole, never corporeal, and never naked. Looking at him now, Beanri knew Gandalug's prison was gone, that Gandalug was returned exactly as he had been the moment Beanri had captured him, except for his clothes. The battered old dwarf looked up at his captor, his tormentor. Beanri had spoken in the drow tongue, and, of course, Gandalug hadn't understood a word. That hardly mattered, though, for the old dwarf wasn't listening. He was, in fact, beyond words. Struggling, growling, with every pained movement, Gandalug forced his back to straighten, then put one, then the other leg under him and rose determinedly. He understood that something was different. After centuries of torment and mostly emptiness, a fugue state in a gray void, Gandalug Battlehammer felt somehow different, felt whole and real. Since his capture, the old dwarf had lived a surreal existence, had lived a dream surrounded by vivid, frightening images whenever this old wretch had called him forth, encompassed by interminable periods of nothingness where place and time and thought were one long emptiness. But now Gandalug felt different, felt even the creaks and pains of his old bones. And how wonderful those sensations were!
"Go back!"
Beanri ordered, this time in the tongue of the surface, the language he always used to communicate with the old dwarf.
"Back to your prison until I call you forth!"
Gandalug looked around, to the chain lying on the floor, the tooth ring nowhere in sight.
"I'm not for tinkin' so,"
the old dwarf remarked in his heavy, ancient dialect, and he advanced a step. Beanri's eyes narrowed dangerously.
"You dare?"
she whispered, drawing forth a slender wand. She knew how dangerous this one could be, and thus she wasted no time in pointing the item and reciting an arcane phrase, meaning to call forth a stream of webbing that would engulf the dwarf and hold him fast. Nothing happened. Gandalug took another step, growling like a hungry animal with every inch. Beanri's steely-eyed gaze fell away, revealing her sudden fear. She was a creature weaned on magic, who relied on magic to protect her and to vanquish her enemies. With the items she possessed, which she carried with her at all times, and her mighty spell repertoire, she could fend off nearly any enemy, could likely crush a battalion of toughened dwarven fighters. But without those items, and with no spells coming to her call, Matron Beanri was a pitiful, bluffing thing, withered and frail. It wouldn't have mattered to Gandalug had a titan been standing before him. For some reason he could not understand. He was free of the prison. Free, and in his own body, a sensation he had not felt in 2,000 years. Beanri had other tricks to try, and in truth some of them, like the pouch that carried a horde of spiders that would rush to her call, had not yet fallen into the chaotic and magical web that was the time of troubles. She couldn't chance it, though, not now, not when she was so very vulnerable. She turned and ran for the door. The corded muscles of Gandalug's mighty legs tightened, and the dwarf sprang, clearing the 15 feet to get to the door before his tormentor. A fist slammed Bayenri's chest, stealing her breath, and before she could respond, she was up in the air, twirling around over the enraged dwarf's head. Then she was flying to crash and crumple against the wall across the room.
"I'm to be ripping your head off,"
Gandalug promised as he steadily advanced. The door burst open, and Bergignon rushed into the room. Gandalug spun to face him as Bergignon drew his twin blades. Startled by the sight, how had a dwarf come into Menzo Berenzon, into his own mother's private chambers? Bergignon got the blades up just as Gandalug grabbed them, one in each hand. Had the enchantment still been upon the weapons master's fine blades, they would have cut cleanly through the tough dwarven flesh. Even without the enchantment, the magic lost in the swirl of chaos, the swords dug deeply. Gandalug hardly cared. He heaved Bergignon's arms out wide, the slender drow no match for his sheer strength. The dwarf whipped his head forward, crashing it into Bergignon's supple armor, slender rings that also relied on enchantment for their strength. Gandalug repeated the movement over and over, and Bergignon's grunts fast became breathless gasps. Soon the young Bayenri was out on his feet, hardly conscious as Gandalug yanked the swords from his hands. The dwarf's head came in one more time, and Bergignon, no longer connected to and thus supported by the dwarf, fell away. Still ignoring the deep cuts on his hands, Gandalug threw one of Bergignon's swords to the side of the room, took the other properly in hand, and turned on Matron Bayenri, who was still sitting against the wall trying to clear her thoughts.
"Where's your smile?"
the dwarf taunted, stalking in.
"I'm wanting a smile on your stinking face when I hold up your head in me hand for all to see."
The next step was the dwarf king's last. As an octopus-headed monstrosity materialized before him, its grotesque tentacles waving his way. A stunning blast of mental energy rolled Gandalug over, and he nearly dropped the sword. He shook his head fiercely to keep his wits about him. He continued to growl, to shake his hairy head, as a second blast, then a third, assaulted his sensibilities. Had he held that wall of rage, Gandalug might have withstood even these, and even the two subsequent attacks from Mephil. But that rage melted into confusion, which was not a powerful enough feeling to defeat the mighty Illithid's intrusions. Gandalug didn't hear the drow-made sword fall to the stone. Didn't hear Matron Bayenri call out for Mephil and for the recovering Bergignon as she instructed the pair not to kill the dwarf. Bayenri was scared. Scared by these shifts in magic that she could not understand. But that fear did not prevent her from remembering her wicked self. For some unexplained reason, Gandalug had become alive again, in his own body and free of the apparently disintegrated ring. That mystery would not prevent Bayenri from paying this one back for the attack and the insult. Bayenri was a master at torturing a spirit. But even her prowess in that fine art paled, beside her abilities to torture a living creature.
"Guinevere!"
The figurine was wickedly hot now, but Drizzt held on stubbornly, pressed it close to his chest, his heart. The wisps of smoke were running up from the edge of his cloak, and the flesh of his hands was beginning to blister. He knew when he would not let go. He knew that Guinevere would be gone from him forever, and like a friend hugging close a dying comrade, Drizzt would not let go, would be there to the end. His desperate calls began to lessen. Not from resignation, but simply because his voice could not get past the lump of grief in his throat. Now his fingers, too, were burning, but he would not let go. Caddy Bree did it for him. On a sudden, desperate impulse, the young woman, herself torn with the pain of grief, grabbed roughly at Drizzt's arm and slapped hard the figurine, knocking it to the ground. Drizzt's startled expression turned to one of outrage and denial, like the final burst of rage from a mother as she watched her child's casket lowered into the grave. for the moment the figurine hit the ground, Catti Bree drew Kazidhea from its sheath and leaped to the spot. Up went the sword over her head, its fine edge still showing the red line of its enchantment.
"No!" Drizzt cried, lunging for her. He was too late.
Tears rimming her blue eyes, her thoughts jumbled, Catti Bree found the courage for a last desperate try, and she brought the mighty blade to bear. Kazidhea could cut through stone, and so it did now, at the very instant that Guinevere went through the breach. There came a flash and a throbbing pain. A pulsating magic shot up Catti Bree's arm, hurling her backward into the ground. Drizzt skidded, pivoted, and ducked low, shielding his head as the figurine's head fell free, loosing a line of raging fire far out into the air. The flames blew out a moment later, and a thick gray smoke poured from the body of the broken figurine. Gradually, Drizzt straightened from his defensive crouch, and Catti Bree came back to her senses, both to find a haggard-looking Guinevere, the panther's thick coat still smoking, standing before them. Drizzt dived to his knees and fell over the panther, wrapping Guinevere in a great hug. They both crawled their way to Catti Bree, who was still sitting on the ground, laughing and sobbing, though she was weak from the impact of the magic.
"What have you done?" Drizzt asked her.
She had no immediate answers. She did not know how to explain what had happened when Kazidhea struck the enchanted figurine. She looked to the blade now, lying quiet at her side, its edge no longer glowing, and a burr showing along its previously unblemished length.
"I think I've ruined me sword," Catti Bree replied softly.
Later that same day, Drizzt lounged on the bed in his room in the upper levels of Mithril Hall, looking worriedly at his panther companion. Guinevere was back, and that was a better thing, he supposed, than what his instincts had told him would have happened had Catti Bree not cut the figurine. A better thing, but not a good thing. The panther was weary, resting by the hearth across the small room, head down and eyes closed. That nap would not suffice, Drizzt knew. Guinevere was a creature of the astral plane, and could truly rejuvenate only among the stars. On several occasions, necessity had prompted Drizzt to keep Guinevere on the material plane for extended periods. But even a single day beyond the half the cat usually stayed left Gwen exhausted. Even now, the artisans of Mithril Hall, dwarves of no small skill, were inspecting the cut figurine, and Brunner had sent an emissary out to Silvery Moon, seeking help from Lady Illustrial, as skilled as any this side of the great desert Onorok in the ways of magic. How long would it take? Drizzt wondered, unsure if any of them could repair the figurine. How long could Guinevere survive? Unannounced, Catti Bree burst through the door. One look at her tear-streaked face told Drizzt that something was amiss. He rolled from the bed to his feet and stepped toward the mantel where his twin scimitars hung. Catti Bree intercepted him before he had completed the step and wrapped him in a powerful hug that knocked them both to the bed.
"All I ever wanted," she said urgently, squeezing tight.
Drizzt likewise held on, confused and overwhelmed. He managed to turn his head so he could look into the young woman's eyes, trying to read some clues.
"I was made for ye, Drizzt O'Erden,"
Catti Bree said between sobs.
"You're all that's been in me thought since the day we met."
It was too crazy. Drizzt tried to extract himself, but he didn't want to hurt Catti Bree, and her hold was simply too strong and desperate.
"Look at me," she sobbed. "Tell me ye feel the same."
Drizzt did look at Catti Bree, as deeply as he had ever studied the beautiful young woman. He did care for her, of course he did. He did love her, and he'd even allowed himself a fantasy or two about this very situation. But now, it seemed simply too weird, too unexpected and with no introduction. he got the distinct feeling that something was out of sorts with the woman, something crazy, like the magic all around them.
"What of Wolfgar?"
Drizzt managed to say, though the name got muffled as Catti Bree pressed tightly, her hair thick against Drizzt's face. The poor drow could not deny the woman's allure, the sweet scent of Catti Bree's hair, the warmth of her toned body. Catti Bree's head snapped as if he had hit her.
"Who?"
It was Drizzt's turn to feel as if he had been slapped.
"Take me,"
Catti Bree implored. Drizzt's eyes couldn't have gone any wider without falling out of their sockets.
"Wield me,"
she cried.
"Wield me?"
Drizzt echoed under his breath.
"Make me the instrument of your dance," she went on. "Oh, I beg. It is all I was made for, all I desire."
She stopped suddenly and pushed back to arm's length, staring wide-eyed at Drizzt as though some new angle had just popped into her head.
"I am better than the others,"
she promised slyly.
"What others?"
Drizzt wanted to scream, but by this point the drow couldn't get any words out of his slack-jawed mouth.
"As are yourself," Catti Bree went on. "Better than that woman, I'm now knowing."
Drizzt had almost found his center again, had almost regained control enough to reply, when the weight of that last statement buried him. "Damn the subtlety," the drow determined, and he twisted and pulled free, rolling from the bed and springing to his feet. Catti Bree dived right behind him, wrapped herself around one of his legs, and held on with all her strength.
"Oh, do not deny me, me love!"
she screamed, so urgently that Guinevere lifted her head from the hearth and gave a low growl.
"Wield me, I'm begging! Only in your hands might I be whole!"
Drizzt reached down with both hands, meaning to extract his leg from the tight grip. He noticed something then on Catti Bree's hip that gave him pause, that stunned him and explained everything all at once. He noticed the sword Catti Bree had picked up in the Underdark, the sword that had a pommel shaped into the head of a unicorn. Only it was no longer a unicorn. It was Catti Bree's face. In one swift movement, Drizzt drew the sword out of its sheath and tugged free, hopping back two steps. Kesidhea's red line, that enchanted edge, had returned in full and beamed now more brightly than ever before. Drizzt slid back another step, expecting to be tackled again. There was no pursuit. The young woman remained in place, half sitting, half kneeling on the floor. She threw her head back as if in ecstasy.
"Oh, yes!"
she cried. Drizzt stared down at the pommel, watched in blank amazement as it shifted from the image of Catti Bree's face back into a unicorn. He felt an overwhelming warmth from the weapon, a connection as intimate as that of a lover. Panting for breath, the drow looked back to Catti Bree, who was sitting straighter now, looking around curiously.
"What are ye doing with me sword?"
she asked quietly. Again she looked around the room, Drizzt's room, seeming totally confused. She would have asked,
"And what am I doing here?"
Drizzt realized. Except that the question was already obvious from the expression on her beautiful face.
"We have to talk,"
Drizzt said to her.
Chapter 9 Implications. It was rare that both Gromf and Triel Beanri would be in audience with their mother at the same time. Rarer still that they would be joined by Bergignon, Sosumtu, and the two other notable Beanri daughters, Bladen Kirst and Quenthel. Six of the seven sat in comfortable chairs around the dais in the chapel. Not Bladen Kirst, though. Ever seeming the caged animal, the most sadistic drow in the first house paced in circles, her brow furrowed and thin lips pursed. She was the second oldest daughter behind Triel, and should have been out of the house by this time, perhaps as a matron in the academy, or even more likely, as a matron mother of her own, lesser house. Matron Bayenry had not allowed that, however, fearing that her daughter's simple lack of civility, even by drow standards, would disgrace House Bayenry. Trielle looked up and shook her head disdainfully at Bladenkirst every time she passed. She rarely gave Bladenkirst any thought. Like Vendez Bayenry, her younger sister, who had been killed by Drisdo Erden during the escape, Bladenkirst was an instrument of her mother's torture and nothing more. She was a buffoon, a showpiece, and no real threat to anyone in House Bayenry above the rank of common soldier. Quenthel was quite a different matter, and in the long interludes between Bladenkirst's passing, Trielle's stern and scrutinizing gaze never left that one, and Quenthel returned the look with open hostility. She had risen to the rank of High Priestess in record time and was reputed to be in Lolth's highest favor. Quenthel held no illusions about her tentative position. Had it not been for that fact of favor, Trielle would have obliterated her long ago. For Quenthel had made no secret of her ambitions, which included the stepping stone as matron mistress of Eric Tynalith, a position Trielle had no intention of abandoning.
"Sit down!" Matron Bayenry snapped finally at the annoying Bladenkirst.
One of Bayenry's eyes was swollen shut, and the side of her face still showed the welt where she had collided with the wall. She was not used to carrying such scars, nor were others used to seeing her that way. Normally a spell of healing would have cleaned up her face, but these were not normal times. Bladenkirst stopped and stared hard at her mother, focusing on those wounds. They carried a double-edged signal. First, they showed that Bayenry's powers were not as they should be, that the matron mother, that all of them, might be very vulnerable. Second, coupled with a scowl that perpetually clouded the worried matron mother's features, those wounds reflected anger. Anger outweighed the perceived and likely temporary vulnerability, Bladenkirst wisely decided, and sat down in her appointed chair, her hard boot, unusual for drow but effective for kicking males, tapped hard and urgently on the floor. No one paid her any attention, though. All of them followed Matron Bayenry's predictable, dangerous gaze to Quenthel.
"Now is not the time for personal ambitions," Matron Bayenry said calmly, seriously.
Quenthel's eyes widened, as though she had been caught completely off guard.
"I warn you," Matron Bayenry pressed, not the least deterred by the innocent expression. "As do I," Trielle quickly and determinedly interjected.
She wouldn't usually interrupt her mother, knew better than that, but she figured that this matter had to be put down once and for all, and that Bayenry would appreciate the assistance.
"You have relied on Lolth's favor to protect you these years, but Lolth is away from us now, for some reason that we do not understand. You are vulnerable, my sister, more vulnerable than any of us."
Quenthel came forward in her seat, even managed a smile.
"Would you chance that Lolth will return to us, as we both know she shall?" the younger Bayenry hissed. "And what might it be that drove the Spider Queen from us?"
As she asked the last question, her gaze fell over her mother, as daring as anyone had ever been in the face of Matron Bayenry.
"Not what you assume," Trielle snapped.
She had expected Quenthel to try to lay blame on Matron Bayenry's lap. The removal of the matron mother could only benefit ambitious Quenthel, and might indeed restore some prestige to the fast-falling house. In truth, even Trielle had considered that course, but she had subsequently dismissed it, no longer believing that Matron Bayenry's recent failures had anything to do with the strangeness going on around them.
"Lolth has fled every house."
"This goes beyond Lolth."
Gromph, the wizard whose magic came from no god or goddess, added pointedly.
"Enough!"
said Bayenry, looking around alternately, her stare calming her children.
"We cannot know what has brought about the events. What we must consider is how those events will affect our position."
"The city desires a paradine," Quenthel reasoned.
the drow word for scapegoat. Her unblinking stare at Bayenri told the matron mother who she had in mind.
Fool!
Bayenri snapped into the face of that glare. Do you think they would stop with my heart? That blunt statement caught